juvenile crime rates had fallen back to the levels of the early 1980s, as the economy improved and crack use abated. By then, however, the hysteria had cemented into policy. Nearly every state had passed harsher sentencing laws for juvenile offenders. Children were being tried as adults and receiving mandatory minimum sentences, including life terms. Pregnant cocaine users were charged with child abuse and even manslaughter. In Chicago, annual arrests for drugs other than marijuana tripled in less than a decade, with African Americans making up most of those charged. It was during this panic that Vince Lane was touted as a hero. Republicans in Washington praised his aggressive approach, which was seen as a model for other cities to follow. Lane was compared to Joe Louis Clark, the bat-swinging principal of a New Jersey high school who was played by Morgan Freeman in Lean on Me, the movie based on his life. Clark had summarily dismissed hundreds of students who were, he said, leeches, miscreants, and hoodlums. The country needed vigilantes like that who were willing to bend the rules. And Lane was tackling social problems that others thought too intractable and hopeless even to bother with, in the process giving CHA employees a new sense of purpose. Workers under him wore buttons announcing, "I'm part of the solution." He said the gangs who operated in public housing were like playground bullies, and the sweeps were his way to throw the bullies out. In 1990, Lane was featured on the cover of the Chicago Tribune Sunday magazine, standing on the roof of a Cabrini Green high-rise, other towers of tartan red brick rising up around him like battlements. Wearing a dark suit, his arms folded across his chest, Lane was a man reigning over his domicile. But the sweeps were problematic from the start. In addition to being ruled unconstitutional, they were prohibitively expensive. The estimated cost of a single sweep of a single high-rise was $175,000, and that was without the amount paid in overtime to Chicago police officers. "It cost a shitload," Lane acknowledged. He was able to secure additional funds from Washington. The CHA also used money on the anti-crime initiative that could have gone to major repairs. The building suffered further decline. And whenever Lane swept a high-rise, crime increased in the surrounding buildings. He wasn't so much removing guns and drugs and miscreants as shifting them around. With each raid, fewer weapons and drugs were confiscated, as people anticipated the invading force. J.R. Fleming said news of the approaching CHA army would reach a building at Cabrini Green, and those with contraband would gather up their goods and store them outside in the trunks of cars. Lane also knew enough about the world of public housing to understand that there was something counterproductive in removing every male who wasn't on a lease. Officially, women headed 9 of 10 households in CHA properties. Men were around, though. They were people's sons and lovers and fathers. "I was conflicted," Lane would admit. Who was he to say if the guys were drug dealers, or good fathers, or both? To tear somebody out of this family environment was, I thought, wrong, Lane said. It wasn't the right thing to do, the right signal to send. We wanted to send the signal that if you share a relationship with someone and have kids, we will work with you, help you get an education and all that. But I continued to move ahead and secure building after building. I really thought we could secure most of the city. Who would have thought that you could secure Robert Taylor and Cabrini Green? Did I succeed? He'd answer the question himself, his voice breaking into a higher register. Absolutely. Absolutely. J.R. Fleming. Because he was straight out of the suburbs, J.R. did run into some trouble at Cabrini Green. Sporting his all-red football letterman jacket, with the collar popped up like Fonzie from Happy Days, he didn't realize that its color represented the Vice Lords and Cobra Stones. One time a disciple near Jenner School demanded of him, What do you ride? J.R. took the question literally, not even trying to be funny. The bus? He was at first perplexed that because he now stayed in a building controlled by the gangster disciples, he couldn't cross the blacktop and visit the building where he lived as a child that was now home to Cobra Stones. After the mostly white community of Dalton, he expected Cabrini Green to be an all-black world, free of tensions and bigotry. What is this? He asked. Black people don't like black people? When he attended Lincoln Park High School in the fall, everyone assumed he was in the Disciples, because his cousins and next-door neighbors were in the gang. He would tell people that he wasn't folks. I'm a nerd. I'm an athlete. I'm competitive. It didn't matter. A group of vice lords chased him out of the pool, J.R. racing home in his swim trunks. Back on the land at Cabrini, people teased him. You're not in Kansas anymore. Then tell me where I'm at and what I need to do to survive, J.R. would demand. He was walking one day, pushing a bicycle, when a couple of guys on Larrabee started telling him that they were going to rob him. Can I see your bike? I just want to ride, man. The bike belonged to his cousin, G-Ball, from 1117 North Cleveland, the castle. No way was J.R. giving it up. He decided he needed to defend himself. This wasn't dunking a basketball or rushing for a first down. A family member lent him a .32 automatic. The following day he was heading up Larrabee with a girl named Trisha, and he told her about his predicament. I got this right here for them, he said, showing her the pistol in his pocket. The weapon didn't surprise her. Shoot them in the leg, she suggested as moderation. But when they came upon the guys, Trisha turned out to be related to them. You're not shooting my cousins, she said, shouting. He's got a gun. You really got a gun for us? Laughed the bigger of the two. A guy people at Cabrini called Frank Nitti, after Al Capone's enforcer. He seemed amused, as if J.R. hadn't been in on the joke. We were just fucking with you, man. He and J.R. would later become friends. J.R. was inclined to see the world through the lens of sports, so he tried to approach Cabrini Green as if it were a football game, discerning the rules amid the disorder. You just need to follow your blockers. Follow your blockers and you'll survive, he told himself. He went to G-Ball and read through the disciples' literature. One of the gang's first tenets was that the GDs aided and assisted their own members. But J.R. looked around and saw that the gang was making a lot of its drug money in the whites, the towers across Division Street. His red high-rise on Larrabee was on the front lines, directly across from a 19-story vice lord's tower. It didn't seem like anyone was too interested in aiding and assisting them. J.R. phoned his father. Willie Sr. told J.R. to stay out of the gangs. He said J.R.'s brain worked differently than the brains of other guys in the projects, that he was too smart to get involved in petty battles. The advice played to J.R.'s ego. Don't be a pawn in another man's game of chess, his father counseled. Instead of gangbanging, J.R. formed a clique in his building called Ski Love, which was mostly about throwing parties, selling a little weed, and hooking up with girls. Their motto, bang, 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 ski, ski, ski. After being run out of Lincoln Park, J.R. tried another area high school, Wells, a mile and a half west. But he didn't see any learning happening there. Students brought guns and knives to school in their shoes. The Puerto Ricans fought the blacks, who fought other blacks. One day, a posse of Spanish Cobras was waiting for him outside the school. J.R. knew he couldn't fight the entire neighborhood. He elected, instead, to punch the assistant principal. He would be expelled. But he reasoned correctly that the police would come and drive him home, past the waiting gangbangers. It tore up his mother, but J.R. was done with school forever. 9. Faith brought us this far. Dolores Wilson. When the job of president of her building opened up suddenly, Dolores Wilson wrestled with whether to take it. Like the prayer said, she needed help distinguishing between what she could and couldn't change. Her own apartment she could control, but an entire building? The roof leaked, and flooded apartments were left to rot. The top two floors were eventually closed off altogether. People weren't supposed to go up there, but they did. Gang signs were scrawled sloppily over the stairwells and elevators. Garbage collected on the landings. It got to the point where Dolores felt too embarrassed to invite anyone over. "I can't have visitors come through all this to get to my house," she'd say. For many years, the president of the tenant council in 1230 North Burling was a friend of hers named Ethelrene Ward. Miss Ward worked with Marion Stamps to demand better services for tenants, and she helped start a community pantry. She let teenagers put on shows in the building, and she organized outings for the residents to the Wisconsin Dells and to a small lake where they played volleyball and fished, though Dolores couldn't stand to put the hook through the worm. When Miss Ward died, a reverend who lived in the building took over, but he'd been discovered recently shot dead in an elevator. People said he'd gotten mixed up in a domestic dispute. Dolores believed that preachers should be judged not by their actions, but by their inspiring words, and she liked how at funerals the reverend would say, "I'm not talking to the deceased. She can't hear me. I'm talking to all of you in the audience." But now he was the deceased, and she was still seated in the pews. She decided to take on the responsibility and succeed him as president. She called her first meeting about a year after Hubert's death. Debbie and Cheryl, her daughters, both had their own apartments in the building now, so Dolores knew they'd show up. But she figured few others would come. When she walked into the first floor rec room, though, she discovered it crowded with seniors and single mothers and little children and even some gang members. The older tenants talked about restoring 1230 North Burling to its original glory in the early 60s, when it was freshly painted and surrounded by green grass, flowers, and benches. The young parents complained about the gangs charging them to ride the elevators, about their children being beaten up and robbed. And the gangbangers who were present agreed for the most part. They, too, were offended by the conditions in the high-rise. One of the gang leaders raised his hand and suggested putting stools on each floor, since children who couldn't reach the trash chutes were spilling garbage or leaving bags on the ground. A dozen people at the meeting volunteered to monitor the building in shifts. All but one of them was a woman, and many of their neighbors called them crazy, saying they were going to get shot. But they went up to the gang members and told them to set up someplace else. They worked in teams, one stationed by the back door leading to Halsted Street, another watching the front, and others on the elevators. When Kelvin Cannon moved into the Burling building after his release from Stateville, he took a shift as well, safeguarding the elevators even as he led the disciples. Dolores pressured the CHA into replacing lights in the lobby and installing a phone there. One woman sold candy out of her apartment, and with the proceeds, the security team bought blue uniforms with a 1230 Burling patch sewn into the sleeve. Eventually, the CHA paid some of them as security guards. They carried walkie-talkies and clipboards, keeping a list of every unlocked vacant unit and broken window to send on to the housing authority. "This is where we live, and we have to protect it," Dolores said. "We started laying down the law, and we found out the law was on our side." The CHA allotted the building a small monthly stipend for miscellaneous expenses, enabling Dolores to outfit the rec room with a used pool table, a ping-pong table, and a thrift shop sofa with a psychedelic design. She convinced a local store to donate 10 gallons of paint, and she paid men from the building $6 for each stairwell they painted. Some of them were so eager for work that they did 2 or 3 floors on their own. In the summer, the building hosted a rummage sale, and residents hung clothes on the fence outside. They set up grills and sold hot dogs and refreshments. A couple of tenants planted a garden on the empty land alongside the building, There was a fashion show, a coat giveaway, and a tutoring program. Dolores conscripted children to help with the tower's upkeep. The same boys and girls who might have fooled around on the elevators now wore pieces of paper with the word monitor taped to their shirts. They walked the high-rise in pairs, making sure other children didn't litter, prop open the elevator doors, or jump out of the cabins. Mayor Washington's administration gave the building a permit to block off Scott Street, just to the north of the high-rise, and the residents held a jump rope contest and a big wheel race. Because she hated competitions, the whole idea of grown people yelling when a ball didn't go in a net or a glove, Dolores awarded each child a prize. Neighbors told Dolores that they never imagined they'd clean up after someone else, but the building was looking so good that they had reached down and picked up a potato chip bag from the lobby floor. Dolores soon felt comfortable enough about the state of the high-rise to invite her pastor from Holy Family over for tea. And it thrilled her when he said from her living room that 1230 North Burling looked like no other building in Cabrini Green. Dolores still had her full-time job at the City Water Department, as well as her other volunteer work on local boards and committees. As the secretary of the Tenant Council for all of Cabrini Green, she was taking the minutes at a meeting in 1985 when the talk turned to a curious pilot program being funded by the Metropolitan Planning Council. The civic nonprofit wanted to train tenants in a few public housing developments across the city to take over management duties from the CHA. In recent years, the MPC had considered recommending that all the high-rise public housing in Chicago be torn down. But during the 1980s, both poverty and the number of families in need of low-income housing increased in Chicago, while federal dollars declined and affordable housing options disappeared. The homeless population in Chicago and the number of people on the CHA waiting list swelled. Given those circumstances, Chicago cannot afford to lose any housing for low-income families, including the 38,685 units of public housing, the MPC concluded. Instead, the organization explored the resident management model. The premise was that tenants would be more motivated than housing authorities or private managers to renovate vacant apartments in their buildings, collect rents, and deal with bad neighbors. And besides, nothing else had worked. The resolution that the Chicago City Council passed to create what it called a vision of a brighter possible tomorrow read more like a public housing postmortem. Whereas the abysmal quality of services rendered to residents of Chicago Housing Authority by management is the stuff that horror stories are made of, tracks of 15 to 19-story buildings where at times elevators have been inoperative 70% of the time, residents waiting for years for new shades, for screens for their doors and windows, waiting months for replacement windows and the most simple repairs, and whereas the wholesale flight of working families from Chicago Housing Authority developments have left it a vast urban wilderness, three-quarters of whose adults are unemployed, 80% of whose households are headed by unemployed single mothers. Where welfare dependence and the welfare mentality hangs like inescapable miasma in the air, coexisting with the all-too-frequent incidents of criminality, marginality, gang violence, alcoholism, drug abuse, and other self-destructive behavior bred by the unbroken landscape of poverty and desperation. The idea that residents of public housing be put in charge of their own buildings was born not only out of desperation, but also from an unlikely union between conservatives and black activists. Resident management meant jobs and skills for African-American tenants that might lead to success outside public housing. This self-empowerment aligned with the rights ideal of personal responsibility and a diminished government, what Republicans decried as the trillion-dollar poverty industrial complex established under Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. Chicago wouldn't be the first city to try the experiment. In Boston, St. Louis, Jersey City, and Newark, public housing residents had already formed companies and taken over maintenance and daily operations in their own buildings, although the results had been mixed. Housing authorities remained wary. Landlords and building managers were supposed to be allies, partners in operating any property. Yet in public housing, agencies had long had an adversarial relationship with their tenants. Residents, too, had little to no accounting, hiring, or supervising experience, and the buildings they were put in charge of managing were among the worst in their cities. But tenants embraced the opportunity, and conservative think tanks pushed to expand the venture to other cities. When the Metropolitan Planning Council surveyed residents of Cabrini Green and two other public housing developments in Chicago, it found that many of the unemployed single mothers would much rather work than receive benefits. They'd been trained as seamstresses, cosmetologists, cashiers, teachers, secretaries, and cooks. Here was an untapped pool of labor. The brave pioneers of resident management are sowing the seeds of hope and possibility in cities across our nation, Ronald Reagan declared from the White House. Dolores Wilson didn't think too much of the idea when she first heard about it. "I didn't even know what resident management meant," she'd say. But then someone from the MPC phoned her at the water department. Because the people in her high-rise had shown initiative, because they'd already done so much to better their home, the person hoped that Dolores and the other residents in her building would apply for the program. Dolores sought the advice of one of her neighbors, Cora Moore. A mother of six, Moore worked for the CHA as the assistant manager of 1230 North Burling and had lived at Cabrini Green since 1969. Yeah, we want resident management, she shouted, saying this was the opportunity they'd been waiting for. Dolores signed them up. There was a 10-year-old from the Reds named Rodnell Dennis. He didn't have JR's way with words or athletic abilities. He wasn't shrewd or confident like Kelvin Cannon, but he was big and powerful for his age, and he'd acquired the nickname Dirty Rod. He'd do dirt on other little kids, grabbing them by the neck as they were heading to the candy store on Orleans Street and robbing them of their change. Also, he'd admit himself, he was plain dirty. His mother got hooked on drugs and stopped mothering. His father wasn't around. The family had little money, and his clothes were raggedy and unwashed. Rod was surprised one day in 1989 when a gangster disciples coordinator told him the gang had been checking him out for a few years and liked what it was seeing. He said the GDs didn't usually bring young fellas into the fold, but they recognized in Rodnell a fearlessness and believed with a little guidance he could be someone. A boy starving for sustenance of all sorts, Rodnell was spellbound by the praise. He was introduced to the GDs operating on the Wild End, the southern portion of Cabrini Green that included some of the Red Towers and the row houses. "What do you feel you can do for this organization?" a GD governor asked him. "I can do whatever you want me to do," Rodnell shouted too quickly, and the group of young men around him laughed. The gang members saw that Rodnell lacked for many things, and they gave him new shoes and clothes, all in the GD colors of black and blue. In return, he was expected to make certain sacrifices. For someone at the bottom rung of the organization, that meant security time. Every day after school, from 3:30 until 9, he stood outside one of two high-rises. Others sold drugs from inside the building. His job was to yell, "One time, lights out," when the police approached. The disciples always talked about the five P's. Proper preparation prevents poor performance. Rod now lived by this credo. He attended regular meetings the gang held at the Lower North Center, in the gym or pool room, where they discussed business and neighborhood events of the past week. They were instructed that it was their job to take out their enemies. They were at war with the vice lords and the stones in the nearby towers. A higher-up would say, "Who wants to go on a mission?" Rodnell, eager to show how motivated he was, would be among the first to volunteer. When he was 13, in March 1992, Rodnell went on a mission. It was a freezing Sunday afternoon, and one of Rodnell's best friends, a boy who would soon be killed, stepped into a circle of GDs. He held out a handgun, a silver 22. He'd spotted a group of vice lords not far from Jenner School. Who among them was going to teach the vice lords a lesson? Rodnell reached for the gun. He ran over to the 500 West Oak building, a couple hundred feet away, and ducked behind a dumpster by the old death corner. People were gathered outside the front entrance of the high-rise. Rodnell could hear the sound his gun made, feel the recoil, but otherwise his mind went blank. When he realized he'd emptied the chamber, he ran back to his building, handing off the gun to another boy, who hid it inside an elevator shaft. He took a seat on the stairs outside the tower, breathing heavily into the cold air, and tried to act as if nothing had happened. And maybe nothing had. Less than 10 minutes had passed since he'd grabbed the gun, and here he was, back where he'd started. For most shootings, a cop car or maybe two showed up. But 10 now raced down Oak, along with an ambulance. Rodnell had to check out the commotion, and he returned to the scene of the crime, sauntering over as casually as he could. Yellow tape surrounded the building's entrance, and a white sheet was draped over what had to be a body. The thought of killing someone hadn't actually entered Rod's mind. The victim, he learned, was a boy named Anthony Felton, a 9-year-old who had no part in the Vice Lords or any other gang. Rodnell knew the child's family. He retreated to his building. Two police officers were already up on his ramp talking to his mother. Someone must have identified him as the shooter. He saw a police cruiser and ducked into one of the high-rises. There were two plainclothes cops at Cabrini-Green whom everyone called Eddie Murphy and 21. They were young and black, and they treated the residents with respect, even the guys they arrested, referring to them as their clients. When things were calm at Cabrini, the officers would visit with families in their apartments. They lifted weights with guys, helped run a baseball little league, and challenged boys on the basketball courts to games of 2-on-2. People at Cabrini believed that Eddie Murphy and 21, unlike other cops, wouldn't slap them around or plant dope on them or pocket their money. And when a guy committed a serious crime and had exhausted his options, he sometimes refused to turn himself into anyone else but them. Now the officer known as Eddie Murphy found Rodnell's cousin and asked him to pass along a message. If Rod runs, we'll have to shoot him. Rodnell didn't have anywhere to run. He was 13, and all he knew was Cabrini Green. The next night, sleepless and panicked, he walked over to the police station on the ground floor of the 365 West Oak high-rise and banged on the cage. An officer asked him what he wanted. I heard you all were looking for me. Who are you? The cop asked. I'm Rodnell Dennis. I'm the one that shot that kid. Because of the record he'd amassed since the age of 7, criminal damage to property, petty vandalism, theft, attempted theft, shoplifting, battery, robbery, possession of a weapon, auto theft, he was transferred from juvenile to criminal court and tried as an adult. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 39 years. Eddie Murphy and 21 were James Martin and Eric Davis. Martin was working as a beat cop on the South Side when he issued a couple of traffic tickets to Jesse Jackson Jr., the future disgraced U.S. congressman and son of the famous reverend. After ticketing Jackson, he was transferred to Public Housing North, the commander at Cabrini Green greeting Martin with bemused laughter. On that very first day, he was in a squad car on Oak Street when rival gangs in the red high-rises opened fire on one another. A man jogged over from the row houses to join the gunfight, using the police cruiser with the cops inside it as cover. I'd never seen anything so ignorant in my entire life, Martin said. He'd grown up in public housing himself, at the South Side's Ida B. Wells homes. But he'd had a peach tree outside the row home he lived in with his grandparents. He'd graduated high school and attended West Point for a year. Tenants nicknamed him Eddie Murphy because he had a passing resemblance to the comedian and also because he cracked jokes endlessly, even making fun of a guy's clothes or running style as he was clasping cuffs on him. Eric Davis was so fresh-faced when he showed up for work at Cabrini Green in 1987 that residents called him 21 for the TV show 21 Jump Street, about cops young enough to go undercover as high school students. He'd lived in a Cabrini high-rise as a child in the 1960s, when his family first made the trek north from South Carolina. He went on to become a prep basketball and football star in the uptown neighborhood, and then as a backup point guard, he co-captained the University of Houston basketball team, Phi Slamma Jamma, that featured Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler and lost in the 1982 Final Four to Michael Jordan's University of North Carolina Tar Heels. As a cop, Davis wanted to serve at his former home. Crack cocaine was just starting to ravage the neighborhood. Mothers, long the cornerstone of the community, were disappearing for days, handing off their children for others to watch. In Cabrini Green's white high-rises, a renegade faction of gangster disciples bought drugs from suppliers not sanctioned by the gang's leadership and kept the profits. Across the dividing line of Division Street, you didn't just have disciples fighting Cobra Stones and Vice Lords, but also GD hit squads firing at one another with automatic assault rifles. And the disciples in the whites warred as well with young men in a rival gang who lived a couple of blocks away in the Evergreen Terrace Apartments, a small low-income development next to Marshall Field Garden Apartments on Sedgwick Street. As a way to talk to the kids at Cabrini Green, and as a response to the gangster rap that was then popular, Davis, Martin, and another officer formed a rap group of their own, calling it the Slick Boys, slang for undercover cops. A sometime drug dealer from Cabrini, Pete Keller, known as Queso, helped them with lyrics, which were part rap battle rejoinder and part public service announcement. C is for CHA, which really lacks. D is for the dealers of drugs like crack. E is for the end of the economy. F is for the fathers that I'd rather see. The media embraced the story of the police trying to save lives through music, with headlines such as, "Cops Stay on the Beat." The Slick Boys delivered talks at public schools about the dangers of gangs and drugs. They worked nights at Cabrini, and then by day traveled around the city and later the country to deliver their musical message about the efforts needed to turn around blighted communities. They hired dancers and roadies from public housing. They filmed a music video. A movie was written based on their lives, hinging on an invented beef between a fictional drug lord at Cabrini Green and 21. The two presented as childhood friends, now on opposite sides of the law, and the mic. In the summer of 1991, Eddie Murphy and 21 learned that a security guard in one of the Cabrini high-rises had kidnapped a 13-year-old girl from the building. Michael Keith was 26, and had worked for the private security firm for half a year. The girl was Veronica McIntosh, J.R. Fleming's baby sister, who along with their mother had moved back to Cabrini that June. At 1017 North Larrabee, where they now stayed, Veronica jumped rope with other girls late into the night. One afternoon, she and her 14-year-old cousin were in front of another Cabrini high-rise when Keith pulled up alongside the girls and offered them a ride. They knew him from the building, so after hesitating for a moment, they climbed in. Keith drove a white Oldsmobile Cutlass, a two-door coupe, and Veronica shimmied into the back while her cousin sat up front. For a while, Keith was chatty and amiable, pointing out stores and buildings as he drove them around the near north side. It was when the girls said they were ready to go home that he turned strange. Between long silences, he told them that wasn't what they wanted. At a stoplight, Veronica's cousin jumped out. But as Veronica was sliding out as well, Keith grabbed her and pulled the door shut. She turned to face him. he held a gun pointed at her face. Over the next 20 hours, with Veronica crouched against the red leather back seat, Keith drove silently. He'd park somewhere secluded, climb into the back, rape her, and drive some more. Veronica hardly knew the city, so she had no sense of where they were. During the night, Keith stopped outside a house in a residential neighborhood and tried to get her to come inside. But she clutched the seat and screamed, and he gave up. Later, Veronica learned that it was Keith's home on the south side. She'd blame herself for not going inside with him. J.R. had been with a girl when Veronica was abducted, but he'd since tracked down Keith's home address through the security firm. If she had just gone inside, Veronica told herself in the days and decades to come, then J.R. might have saved her from a dozen more hours of hell. It wasn't until the next day, with Keith bleary and muttering, that Veronica slipped out of his reach and fled the moving car. She ran away along a crowded street. She looked up and saw the Cabrini high-rises in the distance and headed toward them. Keith didn't return to his house, but he did come to work to pick up his paycheck, and Eddie Murphy and 21 were waiting for him. Years later, after Keith had served a 14-year prison sentence, Veronica confronted him in a Southside diner. Up to then, she avoided talking about what she referred to only as the incident. She'd lost her ability to trust people. She believed all men were devious, and she had trouble leaving her own children alone, even with their father. For a while, she'd popped pills and turned violent. With her sister by her side, Veronica asked Keith how he could have done what he did to her. She was 13, a baby. She'd still had dolls lined up in her bedroom. He'd stolen her childhood. Keith didn't apologize or ask for forgiveness. Rather, he smiled coyly as he reflected on their hours together. He said he'd really wanted her, and since it was public housing, he took her. Dolores Wilson. For Dolores Wilson and the other public housing residents training for self-management, it felt like they had enrolled in school. "What we did took longer than college," Dolores would say. They spent hours in workshops and evening sessions, studying best practices for screening tenants and for conserving heat and electricity. They learned how to read a lease. They reviewed the endless rules and regulations issued by the CHA and HUD. They went over how to form committees, bill vendors, and fill out tax returns. "I think I came to know more about housing than Jack Kemp did," Dolores said, referring to the NFL quarterback turned Republican senator turned Secretary of Housing. They went on weekend retreats outside Chicago, where a trainer taught them leadership skills. As managers, they couldn't lord their power over others. They needed to understand that it was better to listen than to speak all the time. In their new positions, they would have to inspire their neighbors. "If no one is following, you aren't a leader," the teacher repeated. But it was also going to be up to them to lay down the law, to put an end to illegal activities in their buildings. They role-played how to resolve conflicts and also to evict tenants whose conflicts couldn't be resolved. The Metropolitan Planning Council called this effort empowerment training, teaching residents how to become participants in the process of managing their buildings and deciding their future. And to model this self-determination, the MPC hired Bertha Gilkey, a resident of a public housing complex in St. Louis. In 1969, Gilkey, 20 and a single mother, organized a system-wide rent strike that lasted 9 months, and she went on to run the tenant group at Cochrane Gardens that took over custodial and management duties from the St. Louis Housing Authority. Cochrane Gardens had been a lot like Cabrini Green. Abutting a gentrifying city center, it was seen as a war zone with rooftop snipers and drug wars. But under resident management, the rehab departments filled to near capacity. Crime fell, and rent collection doubled. Dolores liked Gilkey instantly. The sessions the St. Louis activists led were as much self-help revival meetings as they were classes in operations and finance. Gilkey's voice was husky and operatic. Her hair was cut into an asymmetrical bob, her eyebrows arched in a look of perpetual defiance. She would boom that the tenants had been mistreated and misunderstood for too long, dismissed as pushers, pimps, and dope fiends, as if the poor were without dreams or aspirations. She made the Chicagoans believe in themselves and their desire, their right, to run their own buildings. She'd chosen against being on welfare, she explained to her trainees, a personal act of willful defiance, and she expected as much from them. "What I'm saying is that there is a new day, that you will no longer be crying in the wind," she pronounced. 1230 Burling is going to be a decent, safe, clean, and sanitary place to live. Gilkey would bring them into a tight circle, all of them clasping hands, and lead them in song. "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." She was revolutionary, Dolores would say. When Bertha spoke, she made you listen. You had to. Gilkey emphasized that outsiders wanted them to fail, expected it. Others had been enriching themselves on their backs and wouldn't give that up without a fight. "There's big money in poor folks," she preached. She challenged them to look over the bloated staffs at the Chicago Housing Authority, the deputy deputies and the executive executives. She said that's where the finances meant to improve their buildings had been going for decades. Housing authorities were paid by HUD for units whether they were vacant or filled, so the agencies had no incentive to make their developments better. The CHA had failed to carry out its charge of providing safe harbor for those overlooked and exploited by the private real estate market. It was up to them, the tenants, to change things. Otherwise, they would continue to live in degradation, or worse, on the streets, because cities were going to generate the will eventually to demolish their rundown projects. She'd seen it happen in St. Louis with Pruitt-Igoe, but she was going to show them how to succeed. "The power to control your own destiny is freedom," she proclaimed. Then they joined together in shouting, "I'm fired up! I'm tired, and I can't take it anymore!" Dolores and her neighbors were fired up, but they were also overwhelmed. The task ahead seemed both too tangled up in endless details and too abstract. When they felt about ready to quit, Gilkey took them on a trip to St. Louis. 50 Chicagoans got off the bus at Cochrane Gardens and couldn't believe that what they were seeing was public housing. Under a tenant-led renovation, Cochrane Gardens had added new townhomes to the tracks of concrete that had separated its towers. The high-rise units were rehabbed, the buildings updated and outfitted with balconies overlooking a communal courtyard. Everything was pristine, even the incinerator room. Dolores, wearing her Harold Washington button, declared it unbelievable. Cora Moore nodded in approval, envisioning the possibilities at 1230 North Burling. In the spring of 1988, after 18 months of classes, the trainees from 1230 North Burling were honored at a graduation ceremony held at a downtown Chicago bank. Many of the residents put on their Sunday best, pink and yellow dresses and towering hats ringed by brims as wide as umbrellas. Dolores covered her mouth as she laughed and wept. "I can't succeed without you and more people like you," Vince Lane told the graduates. Dolores wrote a letter to the newspapers, reporting on their achievement. "We have learned many things about tenant management," she noted. "Now we must put it to work and open the minds of all residents if we are to succeed." In 1990, the leaders of 1230 North Burling were designated interim managers of their building. Then, in 1992, after 7 years of preparation, the 1230 North Burling Resident Management Corporation took over an annual budget of $6 million and became responsible not only for providing security, but also for collecting rents, screening tenants, and maintaining the property. In a written statement, its members declared it their mission to provide management programs and services, social, educational, cultural, and spiritual, to better the lives and living conditions of the 1230 North Burling residents. Dolores designed their personalized letterhead, a rough ink drawing of the file cabinet high-rise, the windows colored in to highlight the white facade. The motto, "Faith brought us this far," stretched across the roof and down one side of the tower. Dolores served as the group's president, an unpaid position, and Cora Moore ran the day-to-day operations as the head manager. They created a 7-member elected board of directors and hired a full-time paid staff of 7, which included a leasing clerk, an accountant, and janitors. They recruited 2 residents from each floor to serve as floor captains, and numerous other tenants joined the building's 15 different committees. Wilson required members of the management team to look respectable, since they were now representatives of the building. "I'm not talking about going to the mailboxes in high heels and makeup," she said. "You just have to be decent. Don't come to the lobby looking like hell's a-popping." Potted plants were placed by the mailboxes, and visitors now needed to be buzzed in to enter. The managers inspected every apartment and began the eviction process for tenants who didn't follow the rules. Dolores said they had to keep out undesirables. They started a nursery in the building, covering cinder block walls with yellow and blue hearts. They opened a laundromat on the 2nd floor, negotiating a 60-40 profit split with the company leasing the washers and dryers, the tenants selling tokens out of the management office, so no money accumulated in the machines. "Cabrini tenants awash and still another success," ran a headline. They operated social service programs for young people and senior citizens. They partnered with a nonprofit to build a new $60,000 playground for the hundreds of children who lived in the tower. People from other Cabrini high-rises started approaching Dolores, asking if she could get them an apartment in the building. But she didn't want anyone saying she played favorites, and she referred them to the admissions committee. The building was described in the press as a ray of hope, a shining example of grassroots empowerment. For Dolores, the highest praise came from Washington, D.C. "President Bush named our building a model for the nation," she announced. 10. How Horror Works. J.R. Fleming. After J.R. Fleming was expelled from his high school in 1990 for punching the assistant principal, his mother packed his suitcase and put him on a Greyhound bus headed for Alabama. No way he was going to hang around Cabrini Green all day. Not when they were talking about a murder epidemic in Chicago. J.R. had started spending time with a girl named Donna, who lived on the 3rd floor of his high-rise. He was 17, and she was 15, and pregnant with their child. But J.R.'s mother still sent him away to his father. Willie Sr. was living in Alexander City, a textile town in Tallapoosa County, about halfway between Birmingham and Auburn. When J.R. stepped off the bus, his dad was there to greet him, standing alongside the white sheriff. The two men drove J.R. directly to the police station and showed him the jail. "I hope you're not trouble," the sheriff drawled. "He wouldn't be," J.R. promised. J.R.'s sisters had always been dad hogs whenever Willie Sr. visited Chicago, dominating his every waking moment. Now J.R. had the man to himself. He was put to work doing carpentry and landscaping. But he also passed the days riding around the county with his father, along the river and lake, and past the many sewing factories for Russell Sporting Goods, which hadn't yet moved its manufacturing first to Mexico and then to Honduras. They shot pool together, and shot guns at a range, and drank in bars. His father talked about his experiences in and out of the military, both legal and extra-legal. J.R. listened as his father swapped tales with a group of other Vietnam veterans, the men somehow seeming to run what they called Alex City. J.R. turned 18, and his father made him sign a selective service card, but he also told his son that government work probably wasn't for him. "Be your own man," he chided, and J.R. tattooed on his bicep a scratchy M.O.M. It looked like Mom, but stood for My Own Man. When J.R. returned to Cabrini-Green after 5 months, his life there seemed different, but also much the same. He partied with his ski-love crew in 1017 North Larrabee, but he had a baby now with Donna, a son they named Jonathan. He played in basketball games and in a softball league, leaping to catch fly balls in front of teammates who were hunched in standing slumbers from heroin highs. But the dreams of college sports that had defined his life up to then were over. What J.R. decided he needed to do was make some money. A guy named Joe Peary, who worked at a local youth organization, was impressed with J.R.'s brashness and intelligence. He helped J.R. land his first paycheck job, sorting packages by zip codes for UPS. J.R. lasted less than 3 months at the job. The minimum wage was then $4.25. He couldn't buy Pampers or feed his son on $4.25 an hour. And he sure couldn't afford all the other things he wanted for himself. J.R. was obsessed with cars, and he'd always been drawn to technology, trying to test whatever gadget was new to the market, whether it was a computer, a PDA, a pager, or a video camera. But the taxes were what sealed it for him. When he got that first UPS paycheck and saw that $11 had been withheld, he was furious. He could make more money selling weed in 3 days than he did in an entire week sorting mail. He decided to deal crack. The guys around him who had the cars and the game systems, who were eating like kings, that's what they did. J.R. asked around, but no one at Cabrini would put him on count, giving him the product to sell. Even from Alabama, Willie Sr. still had clout at Cabrini, and he'd asked the local heads to keep his son out of it. G-Ball, J.R.'s cousin from the Castle Crew, told him, "This is what I do, so you don't have to do it." J.R. was anything if not persistent. He convinced one of his ski-love guys to give him some work, so long as they split the profits and word never got back to anyone at Cabrini. The friend had gotten a secret stash from a liquor store owner on Larrabee, who said he'd gotten the drugs from a cop who worked on the west side. J.R. headed way up north, far from Cabrini, walking a block that looked to him like a good place to sell the drugs without anyone from home finding out. He'd worked less than a day when the police nabbed him. They'd been staking out the street, building a case against the Cobra Stones there, and then this dumb, loud-mouthed kid showed up. If they hadn't arrested him, they told J.R., he'd likely have been killed that night. The cops didn't include J.R. in their larger criminal indictment against the Cobra Stones, and as a first-time offender, he avoided jail. That was the end to his brief career as a crack dealer. In little time, J.R. devised a new money-making scheme. It was the spring of 1991, and people in Chicago were fiending as well for Michael Jordan and the Bulls. The team had just swept the Pistons in the playoffs, after losing to Detroit each of the past 3 years, and the Bulls were on their way to their first ever title. Jordan, too, was ascendant, appearing in ads for McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Gatorade, Wheaties, Ballpark Franks, Edge Shaving Cream, Hanes Underwear, Nike, and Chevrolet. The basketball movie Heaven is a Playground, filmed on location at Cabrini Green, was about to hit theaters, and Jordan had initially signed on to play the lead, pulling out after he'd become too famous. When the Bulls beat the Lakers for the championship that June, many of the stores along Larrabee were looted, people in their revelry and despair firing off guns, smashing windows, and pulling out whatever goods they could carry. Several of the local shop owners were Jordanian, from the Middle East country of Jordan, that is, and by then fixtures in the neighborhood. But when one of them tried to protect his business, brandishing a gun in front of his store, someone in the melee took the weapon and beat him with it. What J.R. did was use his unemployment money from the UPS job, plus a little weed money, and buy a stack of bootleg Bulls championship t-shirts from a vendor on Roosevelt Road. Back home and around the Gold Coast, he resold the shirts for twice what he paid, increasing his stock with each re-up. A man unpossessed of an inside voice, incapable of speaking softly, J.R. was a natural salesman. 3 for 25! Got to sell today! He'd bully, boast, sweetweedle. He didn't take no for an answer, wouldn't let customers turn around. He'd do anything, he said, to get the dollar from their pocket. Like any great salesman, what J.R. really peddled at all times was himself. And in that product, he believed spectacularly. J.R. resembled the Bulls backup forward Cliff Levingston, with the same deep-set beaded eyes and wide-mouthed smile, the same broad-shouldered build and leonine head topped with a high-top fade. At clubs around the North Side, J.R. pretended that he was Levingston's son, and he'd get in without a cover charge or score free drinks. When the Bulls were in the playoffs the following season and still weeks away from their second title, J.R. went all in on the repeat merchandise, the hats and shirts with the paired rings or trophies. To increase his profits, he paid off the delivery man who brought the goods to the vendor on Roosevelt Road, giving him $700 for the name and address of the New York distributor. From there, he connected directly with the wholesaler in Malaysia. He found another supplier who sold the hologram stickers that signified an NBA-licensed product, affixing them to the knockoff gear. He hired guys from his Ski Love crew, each of them pushing a shopping cart that had been converted into a rolling sporting goods store, with wood beams set up on three sides to display the wares. They sold the Bulls merchandise by the Rock and Roll McDonald's, on Michigan Avenue's Magnificent Mile, and outside the near North Side's actual sporting goods superstore. J.R. had recently joined the Young Democrats of Cook County, showing up afternoons to clean out the ward offices or haul mats for the Jesse White tumblers. When police officers told him to move along from wherever he'd set up shop, he'd recite the peddling laws he'd memorized. When that didn't work, he let the police know that they could contact Jesse White, Alderman Nateras, or even the mighty boss of the ward himself, George Dunn. Annie Ricks. Settled into her fifth-floor apartment in 660 West Division with her kids and her mother, Annie Ricks refused at first to send her children to the schools in her new neighborhood. Every morning she put them on a bus and train back to the West Side, an hour-long journey each way. I knew the area, she would say of the West Side, so it seemed safer, more manageable. I didn't know anything about Cabrini. But at Schiller, the principal welcomed Annie, assuring her that the Ricks children were going to love it there. He was right. They did love it. Ricks was soon volunteering in their classrooms. From the time she was a little girl in Alabama, she'd wanted to be a teacher. One of her cousins, already in Chicago, had a job in a public school. And that's what Ricks hoped to do, too. And when she was hired as a teacher's aide at one of the Cabrini Green neighborhood schools, it was a dream come true, of sorts. That was just one of her jobs. Annie also managed an after-school program through a local church. At 3 o'clock, she'd leave the elementary school, pick up art supplies and softballs, and lead 2 dozen children from her building to the blacktop. She'd shepherd the kids on long walks, as far as the beaches and Navy Pier, warning them that if they acted up, she would never take them anywhere again. She babysat neighbors' children and worked at another local organization as well, running sports programs and helping Al Carter with his Cabrini Green Olympics. Over the summers, she served free lunches out of the park by her high-rise. Ricks took her own children across Cabrini Green for further tutoring at the old Montgomery Ward headquarters. They went to after-school programs in the neighborhood churches and youth centers, and Ricks rarely missed one of their games. The Ricks were a basketball family, the girls as well as the boys starring on their teams. With 13 of them, Ricks' children filled out entire squads in pickup games at Seward Park. Her older children met Scottie Pippen, when the Bulls star paid to renovate the basketball courts at Durso Park. Ricks gave birth to Rose during the Bulls' third NBA Finals series in 1993, and to Ray.